Everything in life has a more sinister and darker side than what's perceived on the surface. Every piece of media that you consume has something lurking in the shadows of the person or the team who made it. Every movie, every song, every book that you've enjoyed, all has a dark past in some form. But out of all of those, it seems that video games have the capability to house some of the most dark and twisted parts of the creator's mind. From obvious inclusions like Silent Hill's PT, to the most light-hearted games such as Mario, we will pluck every strand of every creepy and twisted mystery these games have to offer. This is the Dark Side of Gaming. Hello, Darksiders. I hope you're doing well. Believe it or not, this will be our season finale, but don't worry, we'll be back better than ever with season 3 before you know it. We've had a lot of great topics this year, and we want to close it out with something especially dark. And that's why we're going to dive into 5 real-life crimes that were based on video games. Don't worry. And now, I know, when people say that, you usually get a bunch of jerks who did something stupid in a rage over the game. I understand there's a big difference between the two. In these cases we discuss here will not include the boy who shot his parents because they grounded him from Halo, nor will it include the idiot who stabbed his neighbor for saying World of Warcraft is only a game. Also, a friendly disclaimer up front. We are not stating that video games cause violence. We're simply relaying a few true stories of instances where people argued that they did. Honestly, we've reached a point where if they did cause violence, there would be way more of these to cover. If you go out and do harm to another person, you're the only one to blame in that scenario. So, with that out of the way, let's get started. You know that feeling you get when you find the perfect game? Everyone looks for different things when choosing what to play next. Whether you prefer racing, fighting, puzzle solving, or just living your best life in The Sims, we all feel that certain tingle when we find what we're looking for. Those are the games that tend to stay with us even after we turn them off. For me, nothing did this better than the Tony Hawk games. After weeks of playing for 6 to 10 hours a day, I would reemerge into the world, and every sidewalk, every randomly parked car, and every light pole was suddenly part of a new map to explore. My eyes saw every surface as part of the next combo. I could feel the buttons beneath my fingers just ready to go. But for some people, this feeling wasn't so innocent. Some people could do this to a very dangerous extent with games like Grand Theft Auto or Call of Duty. Those are the people we're going to talk about here. For our first case, I almost didn't want to use this one because, well, initially, it seems like a typical case of gamer rage, but once I read the full story, I knew it had to be included. I can't begin to tell you how many people have killed or tried to kill simply for losing in a video game. I've seen dozens of cases in the last few days alone, but this situation is different. This wasn't an attack conducted in a blind rage. This was a man making a calculated decision to bring his game into the real world when he couldn't defeat his opponent virtually. Julien Barreau, a Frenchman, was 20 years old in 2010. His entire world revolved around Counter-Strike. He considered himself somewhat unbeatable, so when he lost to a virtual knife fight to another player, it wasn't a defeat he would take lightly. In fact, he would dedicate the next 6 months of his life to finding the perpetrator. Can you imagine being so angry over losing a match that you retained the motivation to kill someone for over 6 months? I wasn't able to find as much information as I would have liked. It's not exactly easy to take someone's gamer tag and find them in real life. He also didn't seem to have a career that would have facilitated this endeavor either. It's not like he worked for the gaming company or some kind of government agency. He was just a regular guy. Well, regular guys don't go around stabbing people, but you know what I mean. The gamer in question is only referred to as Mikhail, and he actually lived in Cambrai, a city north of Paris. Unfortunately, this was only a few miles away from Julian himself. Do we have any mathematicians in the audience? Does anyone know how to determine the odds of these guys living within a few miles of each other? That's insane. Armed with a kitchen knife, Julian walked up to Mikhail's home and stabbed him in the chest after he opened the door. Thankfully, Julian was arrested less than an hour later, and the victim survived, but had the blade struck less than an inch in any direction, the blow would have pierced his heart. I barely understand our own legal system, so I won't comment too much on Julian's sentencing, but 2 years in anger management feels like an incredibly light sentence for attempted murder, especially one that was over 6 months in the making. Julian clearly meant for Mikhail to die. When police asked why he did it, he had no problem admitting he wanted to, quote, wipe out his rival. Look, I love gaming too, but guys, nobody can win them all. When you lose, be graceful about it. Don't be a Julian. Sore losers suck, and everybody hates them. In our second slot, we're going to dive into a Mortal Kombat case from December of 2007, and I want to warn you, this one's pretty brutal. It takes place in Johnstown, Colorado, a small town 40 miles just north of Denver, and involves 16-year-old Heather Trujillo and her 17-year-old boyfriend, Lamar Roberts. Heather had three sisters, a 7-year-old named Zoe, and a set of 3-year-old twins. When their mother worked nights at the Corral Bar, Heather would be left to babysit, and Lamar would often be there as well. The young couple loved Mortal Kombat for its brutal violence and spent many hours playing, often while drinking. You see, the Trujillos weren't the typical family. Neighbors described them as combative, noisy, and disruptive. One even reported them for child abuse after babysitting the younger girls, but nothing came of it. She had them for 4 days and noticed Zoe had a few suspicious bruises. When she asked about them, Zoe first claimed to have fallen down the stairs, but ultimately she admitted Lamar had been hitting her. Unfortunately, Zoe didn't receive the help she so clearly needed. On December 6th, 2007, Heather and Lamar decided to reenact the moves they saw on Mortal Kombat. Simply playing wasn't good enough anymore. The couple began brutally beating the young child, lifting her into the air and dropping her on her side, trying to recreate the moves they had seen so many times. Lamar claimed to be a martial arts expert with hands registered as lethal weapons and even admitted Zoe asked him to stop, though I'm sure it was more of a desperate plea. The reason he didn't, however, is because he was drunk. By his own admission, he performed a back kick on her and then kicked her again as she ran towards him. At that point, she fell down, and she didn't get back up. She was no longer breathing, but the couple didn't call for help just yet. First, they put her in a bath, and for a moment, she seemed to regain consciousness, but quickly stopped breathing again. Lamar then cracked an egg in her mouth to ensure that she, quote, wasn't messing with them, and it went down her throat. Only then, 15 minutes after she first fell unconscious, did they finally call the mother and paramedics, but it was too late. Zoe's official cause of death was blunt force trauma to her brain and central nervous system. Her right wrist was broken, and she was covered in more than 20 bruises. Her neck muscles were bleeding, and a skin flap near her tongue had been torn. 12 days later, the couple would be arrested and charged as adults. Heather was originally charged with felony child abuse, but in May of 2008, she pled guilty to a less serious negligency charge in exchange for her testimony against Lamar. A couple of months later, on July 2nd, Heather received 18 years, which would be suspended if she successfully completed 6 years in the Department of Corrections Youthful Offender Service. It wasn't until January 19th of 2009 that Lamar was finally sentenced to 36 years, which is not long enough if you ask me. But anyways, they seem to still be rotting away in prison for now, and there hasn't been a word written about them past Lamar's trial, at least none that I can find. Now, no one will be surprised to see Grand Theft Auto on the list. Hell, they could have had their own, but I've managed to narrow it down to two, starting with a pair of stepbrothers in Newport, Tennessee. In June 2003, William was 16 and Joshua Buckner was 14. Most of their summer break had been spent at home playing Grand Theft Auto 3. After long hours of shooting into the game's busy streets and watching people flee in terror, they decided to try it out in real life. And why not? I mean, nobody gets hurt when they do it in the game. So, they got into a locked room of their home, grabbed a couple .22 caliber rifles, and carried them up a hill overlooking Interstate 40. Then, they decided to shoot into the passing traffic. They later admitted to the police they were emulating their favorite game, but hadn't meant to hit people. While the results were devastating, I'm surprised they weren't much worse. Somehow, only two people were hit. Kimberly Beattie was 19. She was riding in the passenger seat of her boyfriend's car when she was struck in the pelvis. Thankfully, she survived, but she's been left with 8 bullet fragments as little reminders, and I wouldn't dare speculate how much trauma she must endure. The second victim would suffer an even worse fate. Erin Hamill, who was 45, was a registered nurse from Knoxville, Tennessee. He and his cousin, Denise, had spent a lovely day at the mountains and were headed back home when the tragedy occurred. Erin was driving with his cousin in the passenger seat. One moment, they were laughing, talking, everything was normal. And then, he told her to look at the beautiful flowers. The second she did, her glass shattered and she felt heat across her face. At first glance of the glass and blood, Denise assumed that she had been shot, but as the car began to veer out of control, she looked to Erin. He had a large bullet hole in his head. The car passed oncoming traffic as it crossed the highway and came to a stop after hitting the guardrail. Knowing her cousin would die quickly, she tried to reassure him with thoughtful words in his last moments. The teen shooters pled guilty to reckless homicide, aggravated assaults, and reckless endangerment. It was decided both would be held at a state juvenile detention center until turning 19. They gave brief statements expressing their remorse, though, apology or not, a few years in a juvenile center hardly seems like a fitting punishment, considering a man lost his life, and a woman will live with the physical and psychological trauma of their actions for the rest of hers. Due to the boys blaming their actions on Grand Theft Auto, Erin Hamill's family filed a $246 million lawsuit against Sony, Take-Two Interactive, Rockstar, and Walmart in 2006. But, of course, those who heard our episode about Rockstar Games will remember this is a pretty common occurrence for those guys, and nothing much ever comes out of it. Okay, I know these have been tragic, but the last two are in a league of their own. How many of you are familiar with Devin Moore? His crimes took place in 2003, so I was surprised to only now be learning about him. Within the first few lines of his case, I knew I had to include it here. You see, Devin was from Fayette, Alabama. Aside from it being a small town with nothing to do, he endured a broken home lifestyle, and most of his childhood was spent in and out of foster care. Being an angry teen, Vice City appealed to him on many levels, and he logged hundreds of hours playing, or, as his lawyers would later say, being programmed. Actually, before I tell you what he did, I want to give you a quote from shortly after his second arrest. It says, "Life is like a video game. Everybody's got to die sometime. because this tells you the frame of mind he was in during the early morning hours of June 7th, mere weeks after graduating high school. The 18-year-old decided to take his game into the real world. He went out, stole a car, and just like in the game, he became a wanted man. I'm not sure how long he was able to appreciate his first joyride, but it was Officer Arnold Strickland who captured him. Devin had no criminal history, and he was completely cooperative during the arrest and transportation to the police station. It was while being booked that he snapped and lunged for Officer Strickland without warning. In the blink of an eye, Devin was suddenly holding the officer's gun, and he didn't hesitate to use it. He shot Strickland twice, ending it with a fatal blow to the head. Officer James Crump heard the commotion and then came running, but Devin met him in a hallway. Officer Crump was shot three times, including the final headshot. The suspect continued moving down the hall towards the emergency dispatcher's office. There, he shot Ace Mueller five times and, you guessed it, the last was a kill shot to the head. Devin was quite literally acting out Vice City to its extreme, and he wasn't finished yet. He found a set of car keys, walked to the parking lot, and helped himself to a police cruiser. This entire set of events happened in under 60 seconds. That's how quickly three men lost their lives that night. 1 second, they were booking a scrawny kid for suspicion of car theft, and the next, he was driving off in a stolen cop car. Devin managed to make it across the state line into Mississippi, but was apprehended soon after. When asked why he killed the three officers, he said he didn't want to go to jail. In 2005, Devin pled not guilty, and the judge barred the defense from arguing Grand Theft Auto was to blame for Moore's shooting spree. Instead, they argued their client was suffering from PTSD due to suffering emotional and physical abuse at the hands of his father. That August, the jury found him guilty, and in October, he was sentenced to death by lethal injection. His lawyer, Jim Stanridge, appealed the case, but the judge not only declined the appeal, he revoked the lawyer's temporary license to practice in the state. Standridge would then file a complaint against the judge, which would begin a years-long tit-for-tat of legal filings between the two men, one of which the lawyer would lose shamefully. As with our last Grand Theft Auto case, the victims' families would later go on to sue Take-Two and every other company that they could connect to the game, but the matter was dismissed since there was no law against selling mature video games to minors at the time it was purchased. And for what it's worth, Devin's father, Kenneth Moore, said he always had difficulty disciplining his son and thought he should be charged with capital murder, stating, "You live by the sword, you die by it." That's in the Bible. Our final and most devastating case takes us to Norway in 2011 to discuss Anders Behring Breivik. According to his manifesto, yep, we're talking about one crazy enough to actually make a manifesto, he used Call of Duty as combat training, but let me give you a little background on him first. He's known by a few different names, but just for ease of conversation, we're going to stick with Anders. He was born in 1979, and his mother was... she was crazy. She developed a hatred for her son before he was even born. She believed he was kicking her on purpose and tried to get an abortion, but she was in the UK at the time. When she returned to Norway, she was past the three-month threshold and was unable to have the procedure. Her opinion didn't change after he was born, either. She called him a, quote, fundamentally nasty child, and stopped breastfeeding him because he was also, quote, sucking the life out of her. When Anders was a year old, his parents divorced, and though he would occasionally visit his father, most of his time was spent living with his mother and older half-sister. I know it's a little cliche to blame the mothers, but this case may have a decent argument. Does it excuse his actions? No, of course not, but I'm just saying it wouldn't be completely unreasonable to throw some of the blame on her as well. There were several reports of abuse from his childhood, and multiple psychologists expressed concerns about the effect his mother had on his mental development. She often sexualized him, hit him, and told him she wished he were dead, which is obviously heartbreaking to hear of any mother doing. Needless to say, his upbringing was all around terrible. Norway seems to be one of the countries which require their men to enter military service, and when that time came for Anders, he was rejected. The Norwegian Defense Security Department determined he was unfit for service, and he instead found himself working in the customer service industry. While the company who employed him remains unnamed, co-workers have described him as an exceptional colleague with a big ego. Then, in 2002, at the age of 23, he began a 9-year plan to finance his attack. While continuing to work in customer service, he started a computer programming company. It seemed to do well at first, but after being reported for several violations, the business was declared bankrupt. He didn't walk away with nothing, though. He still had a nice cash reserve, but making up for the loss would require a huge sacrifice. Anders was forced to move back into his mother's home to save money, and some psychiatrists would pinpoint this as the moment his true decline began. Despite his worsening mental health, he began a farming company in 2009, and in 2010, he began purchasing weapons. He initially tried to acquire them illegally in Prague, but when that didn't work, he went through the legal channels in Norway. Without military training, he wouldn't have the knowledge necessary to carry out his plan. And where else was he supposed to receive combat training? A video game, of course. While Anders would learn from many different games, Call of Duty became the main one, and he praised the results in his manifesto. He purchased several more weapons, and in 2011, he moved onto his farm. It was just under 90 miles northeast of Oslo. The sole purpose of this farm was to give Anders a legal reason for purchasing massive amounts of fertilizer. He was even included on a list of 60 names for purchasing explosives, but the police found nothing suspicious when they initially reviewed the report. Then, on July 22nd, Anders was ready to complete his 9-year plan. First, he placed a bomb outside the tower housing the Prime Minister's office in Oslo, and 8 people died. Only a few hours later, he arrived at Utøya Island. This was the location of a campsite for the Workers' Youth League, and by posing as an officer, Anders was able to board their ferry. Once on the island, he would terrorize everyone in attendance for over an hour as he fired at victims intermittently. He killed 69 more in this attack, bringing his grand total to 77. When police arrived, Anders surrendered without resistance and gave a full confession. I don't fully understand his logic when he said why he committed these crimes, but he claimed it was to save Norway and Western Europe from Muslim takeover, and that the Labour Party had to pay the price for letting down the Norwegian people. So, yeah. The legal process afterwards is also a little infuriating. He had access to 3 cells where he could use a computer or watch DVDs whenever he pleased. Honestly, it sounded like he was enjoying himself. He was cut off from the outside world at first, but in 2012, he was able to receive letters and spent much of his time writing back to like-minded individuals. He even asked his lawyer if his manifesto had, quote, begun taking root in society. This case is still ongoing today, and it doesn't seem like it'll be finished anytime soon. An entire season could be done on the court proceedings alone. Well, Darksiders, I guess that wraps it up. But if there are any cases you would have liked to see on the list, drop it in the comments. You never know when we'll do a part 2. Before I go, I want to pass along a huge thank you from our entire team. We appreciate you hanging out with us all season, and we can't wait to show you what we have coming next. In the meantime, don't forget, you'll still have the dark side of YouTube with Autumn Ivy to keep you company. This episode of The Dark Side of Gaming was brought to you by The Dark Swamp Entertainment and produced by Swamp Dweller, backed by Audio Boom. The heart-pounding sound design was produced by Joey Sorlis. The creepy mysteries in this episode were brought together by Paige Turner. These dark tales were voiced and hosted by Derek Weber. Be sure to follow the podcast on iTunes and Spotify to get notified as soon as new episodes come out. And don't forget to rate it to let us know how we did. And leave a comment on what you would like to hear be covered in a future episode.